You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 12, good afternoon to you. You at the Midday Report, where you won't miss a thing. At Stephen Grotus on Twitter, 31567-31702, the SMS numbers. You'll hear about the apparent action against those who sold your oil stocks in the next half an hour, how Donald Trump's lost another spokesperson, and of course, the cheaters will tell you how much they're looking forward to playing in Europe next season. But first, in the High Court in Pretoria, the Reserve Bank now officially asking a judge to overturn the findings of Public Protector Advocate Busisiwe Mkhwebane, who said the constitutional mandate of the bank should be changed. Her findings, you'll remember, led to shares plummeting on the JSE and then fears from ratings agencies that the bank was about to lose its independence. Then Parliament, the National Treasury and the Reserve Bank said they would challenge her findings in court. And then Mkhwebane turned around and simply said she would not contest their application. EWN's Clement Maniatella in the High Court in Pretoria for us. Clement, afternoon to you. The application just started 37 minutes into it. What's the bank said about what happened after her findings were released?
Well, Stephen, the South African Reserve Bank has really concentrated a lot on those harmful consequences. In fact, they're describing them as harmful consequences for the South African economy after, of course, the Public Protector released that remedial action that speaks to the change on the mandate of the Reserve Bank. They're saying, I mean, you'll remember, Stephen, that the Rand weakened, and that's one of the things that was mentioned in court today. Advocate Unterhalter also speaking about how there were also then warnings from ratings agencies. Remember, they were cautioning against touching and meddling with the independence of the central bank. And Unterhalter, the advocate, saying the sort of a continuous harm that is being affected to the South African economy, and that if this remedial action is not reviewed and is not overturned, you could see those rating agencies who were warning against the meddling of that independence really downgrading the country even further.
Mkhwebane is now, I suppose you'd say, Clement, essentially abandoned her own findings. She's not defending them in court. What does the bank say about her conduct in all of this?
So, Stephen, the bank is still yet to deal with that. They have indicated to Judge John Murphy that they'll be dealing about that specifically. But what they did mention about the urgency of their application is that though the Public Protector has abandoned, of course, that remedial action and said she would not be opposing this application, the matter is urgent. That is before the court today, because 60 days deadline that was set by the Public Protector for Parliament to report back on progress is nearing. And that is why the bank is saying there needs to be an official overturn of that remedial action. But what they also dealt in detail with, Stephen, was the grounds for this review application. And one of the things they mentioned was that the Public Protector has fallen into a serious error, because the remedial action on the Reserve Bank doesn't flow from that investigation that was undertaken. That was, of course, about the bailout that was given to Bangkok. And another one was on the separation of powers, that the Public Protector needed to know that the National Assembly must determine if there must be an amendment to the Constitution. In fact, they are referring to that as a grievous failing on her part, that failure to appreciate that only Parliament and not any other official, even the Public Protector, has that role to play in suggesting or even seeking to determine the amendment of the Constitution.
And Clement, Advocate Busisiwe Mkhwebane herself, the Public Protector, I mean, could there be implications for her with what comes out of this court case if the judges make a comment about her conduct?
Well, I think that will be ammunition given, Stephen, that will be given to some of those opposition parties. We know that some opposition parties, particularly the EFF, even the DA, have already raised concerns about the way and the manner in which she has conducted her business. There are people that have questioned her credibility and whether she even understands the Public Protector Act, and never mind the Constitution. So by being critical of the Public Protector in perhaps even the judgment when Judge John Murphy delivers it, that is going to prove as ammunition to those opposition parties and some civil rights organizations that have been calling for her head.
EWN's Clement Maniatella, thanks very much indeed. On the line from the High Court in Pretoria, more from him at EWN Reporter, more testimony, more coming from the Reserve Bank in that application. Well, down the corridor from where EWN's Clement Maniatella, we find EWN's Barry Bateman. This is also in the High Court in Pretoria. Testimony from the former police officer, Jan Rodriguez, who's one of the people who was in the John Foster Square police station when Ahmed Timmel died after falling 10 floors to his death in 1971. Police at the time claimed he committed suicide. The family now been able to arrange a proper inquest. EWN's Barry Bapin, as I say, there for us. Barry, afternoon to you. Rodriguez is one of the last people to have seen Timmel alive. What does he say about how he died?
Yeah, good afternoon, Stephen. Well, Timmel was in fact claimed to be the last person to see Timmel alive. Rodriguez was actually claiming to have witnessed him jumping out the window. Well, Rodriguez has gone into significant detail about that day in 1971, how he, as an admin clerk, he arrived at John Forster Square to deliver two salary checks to police officers, as well as a sealed envelope to one of these particular officers. He says he was led upstairs to the 10th floor. He was led to a room where two police officers, Fanikar and Gloy, were busy interrogating Ahmed Timmel. He says he was led into the room, but shortly before, there was somebody outside the room with three cups of coffee. They asked, did he take it any? He obliged. He took in the cups of coffee. He handed over the envelope and the two salary paychecks. He says at that point, a third person came into the office, a so-called Mr. X, and told the two officers, Juanita and Gloy, about three or so co-conspirators of Timmel, which had been arrested. He described in detail Timmel's face as he was shocked, clearly shocked at what he had just heard. It was at this point that Mr. X left, but then the two officers there, they wanted to go and discuss these new arrests and ask Rodriguez to please remain in the office while they go and investigate this further. The men left, and he was left alone. He says, for a short while, Timmel asked him, could he please go to the bathroom? He says it was a reasonable request, and at this point, when they both stood up, it was in a quick move that Timmel turned around and he went towards the window, opened it, and dived out. What he's also testified about, Stephen, is alleging that senior police officers, including Ms. Gloy and Van Niekerk, put pressure on him to include in his affidavit at the time false statements. These statements included that he should say that he had got into a fight with Timmel prior to him jumping out the window. He said he refused to do this. Judge Billy Motley questioning him on this particular aspect. Why have you waited for nearly 40 years to come up with this version? Because this is new evidence, Stephen. He says he's never had the opportunity to do so.
How is the prosecutor, I mean, he's now under cross-examination, how's the NPA dealing with this evidence? How's it being interrogated?
Well, the NPA's Pretorius is going quite hard on him. He's pointed out at least five now changes to his version. He's put it on record that he's actually tailoring his version as he's going along. I'll give you an example, Stephen. He says that we've given quite a lot of evidence about how secretive the security branch at the time operated, and that Rodriguez, as an administrative clerk, wasn't privy to all the information. He just knew there was an interrogation taking place, but he didn't have all the details. He testified, and this is under cross-examination, that when, after Timmel had jumped, he ran into the corridor and he screamed out for help, saying, Timmel had gesprung, Timmel jumped. The follow-up question was, but you said that everything was secret. How did you know the name Timmel? He then introduced new evidence. He says, no, when you went into the office, Gloy had introduced Timmel as a valuable detainee. Now, this, of course, is further fresh evidence that did not come out in the beginning. When questioned on this year, his fallback position on all the other versions that have been identified, Stephen, is always, it's a long time ago, I can't remember correctly. Clearly frustrating the judge Billy Motley, often having to intervene to quest. You have very specific details about the expression on Timo's face, about the last conversation you had about the toilet, all these fine details. But when these contradictions get pointed out, Stephen, he falls back on the issue that it happened such a long time ago and he can't remember correctly.
Barry, yesterday on the Midday Report, you told us about how the previous witness, another former security police officer, had been told by the judge that he could face charges depending on the outcome of this inquest. Has Rodriguez been given the same warning?
Yeah, quite right, Stephen. At the very beginning of this, and it's obviously the hope on Judge Billy Motley to put it to a witness that if he's bound by the law, that if there is any finding of this particular individual's involvement in the death of Ahmed Timmel, that he, of course, could face prosecution. But where are we going with this particular witness? And it has been put to them that the version provided by Rodriguez is simply a version to cover up the murder of Ahmed Timmel. That, it was put by previous witnesses, that this whole Mr. X version that they couldn't identify that came into the room. The probability of Rodriguez, who is a 6-foot-tall former rugby player, could not reach out and grab Timmel. It's highly improbable. So if it comes to the end of it and it is found that Rodriguez is perhaps party to the cover-up, there could be the possibility of defeating the ends of justice and similar type of prosecution that awaits this particular witness.
EWN's Barry Bateman, thank you very much indeed. More from him in the EWN bulletins, a full roundup of all of that evidence today at ewn.co.za towards the end of the day. Barry, thank you.
The Midday Report with Stephen Hortus.
You with the Midday Report this Tuesday lunchtime, 17 minutes after 12 in Eldorado Park in southern Joburg. A call today from a group of people who say they represent coloured teachers in the area for a national shutdown of teaching after a black principal was appointed to run the Klipspruit West Secondary School in what is seen as a predominantly coloured area. Anthony Williams is an executive member of the organisation Patriots for Equality, who held the press conference this morning. He's on the line from Klipspruit. Anthony, good afternoon. Good afternoon to you. What do you actually want government to do here?
Good afternoon, Stephen. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I think the first thing that we want to do, we want to be on record to say that the misrepresentation of this community in terms of race, that it's a racist, a racist community because it opposed a supposedly black African principal, I think that must be first cleared because it is absolutely inaccurate. We cannot be associated as a community with that kind of racism. And there's been a consistent onslaught against the community in terms of blackness and you know, versus coloredness. We cannot be associated with those kind of things. So that's the first thing that we need to correct.
Can I just
that
check?
The MEC needs to do that. He needs to correct it.
Anthony, so you're saying it would have been the same reaction if it had been a white principal appointed?
Because, and I'll tell you why, even if it was a white principal that was appointed, the due process, there's lots of irregularities that has happened, lots of discrepancies that has happened you know, during the process. And part of that is the reason why we are up in arms and we say that we cannot accept that someone is imposed on the community in the way and in the fashion that the department has done.
So if it was a coloured person from a different part of the country, you would have objected then as well?
Due process, Stephen, again, is critical. It's important. Whether it's a coloured person, whether it is a white person, we have to follow due process. And we are saying that is, that's the flaw currently in the whole debacle.
You have called for a shutdown. You want teaching to stop. You want coloured teachers who support you to stop teaching. Why are you not just talking to government?
You see, the MEC, if it is the MEC, there was an official communique that came out yesterday that says that the GDE is condemning any choke down or any go slow by educators, you know, at all the schools. And this is the reason they gave. They said because all the relevant parties are sitting and working very hard around the table. Stephen, that is an absolute, it's a blatant lie. Because here the community are, we're sitting around here, I'm sitting with the chairperson, we are with everybody here of the SGB. There is nobody that is communicating with the SGB. Nobody's talking to them. The SGB chairperson, you know, is receiving messages via the media. Now, surely something is wrong with that picture.
But the SGB was disbanded last week, Anthony. I mean, he has no authority. As far as the Gauteng provincial government is concerned, he no longer represents the school because, as Panyazi Lusufi told us on this program last week, it's dysfunctional. The point is, what I'm trying to get to is that you, it would appear, are happy to allow education and teaching at other schools to be disrupted because of something that is happening only at the school that you are involved in Klipspruit. Surely that's unfair?
Two things. The MEC has unilaterally disbanded an SGB without due process. We've got to put that on record, number one. Number two, we are talking about historical imbalance. We're talking about an historical and a systematic marginalization that is happening with across all colored communities. This is not something that is exclusive or belongs exclusively to Klipspruit or El Rado Park community. It is something that you just seen in the news in Wentworth, Stephen. The Essegai Primary School has had exactly the same issue where a less qualified, it's not about the fact that it was a black principal that they were imposing on the Wentworth community. It was that there was there was a flaw in terms of this, the person that was appointed there is less qualified than the acting person in that particular position. Surely something is wrong there, Stephen. We can't be sitting around here and in 2017 we continue to perpetuate racial segregation. That's at the heart of this thing. Why are we continuing to refer to Stephen Huertas as a white man and we refer to us as colored and we refer to those people as black? We score a so-called black African woman, we score her 5 points. We score a so-called colored woman or a colored woman, we score her 4 points. Something has gone mysteriously wrong in democratic South Africa.
But it's your community that then objected when a black principal was appointed.
Say that again, Stephen.
You've just said that you believe there is something wrong in South Africa when people are given certain points. I presume you're talking about BE points according to their racial identity, however
absolutely
that can be defined. But it's yes your community that then objected so strongly to a black principal. I mean, if there had been a... Let me just finish the point. If okay there was a black principal or a person, a black person who could be the principal at that school who was from your community, you're saying you would accept that. In the end, is this not a case where you're trying to determine who the principal should be and you don't really care what the Gauteng Education Department says?
No, what we are saying, Stephen, I think this is, again... We must talk about the structural inequalities, Stephen. We have got to talk about, until and unless we have the discussion, you know, on this whole issue around the racism in this country, we're not going to have an honest discussion. You know, we're shooting from the hip. We're emotional. I mean, very much. South Africans need to reimagine the South Africa that we need. We can't be associated with anybody, Stephen, that says, no, we don't want black principal outright. We can't. We are saying that in this particular community, in particular SATU, has imposed upon this community a project called Operation Fat Alles. And by that they mean that every principal's post in the community of El Rado Park will be filled by African black people. There's something wrong, Stephen, with what these guys are doing, and we as a community of colored people have got to sit around and we've got to clap hands when we see we are clearly marginalized. We can't accept that.
Is it, Anthony, because you feel that you are being targeted, or is it because you don't have a voice? I mean, which is it? Is it someone who's actively targeting you, or is it because you don't have a voice?
It's both. It's both. There's and I'll tell you why we say it's both. We are targeted, and there's a concerted effort, you know, to demonize us as racist, right? Colored people have been having black African children in the schools for more than 20 years. Colored teachers, educators were teaching them. There has been never issues like this. So there is a concerted effort to target colored people, in particular colored educators, and to neutralize them and to get them out of the way so that there is more African black people taking the position. So we are targeted. And this is at the heart of the target. It is what happened in Morogoro in Tanzania in 1969 when the ANC has made a policy position when they spoke about blacks and Africans in particular. Now that, Stephen, is at the heart of what we are faced with here in South Africa. The whole concept of racial categorization, which is a colonial formation, and we are perpetuating that, you know, to the exclusion of colored people, and we are beginning to talk about hierarchies of suffering. Now that is, surely, we cannot sit around here and our voice has been drowned, and we are systematically being neutralized and taken out of the equation, and our community must clap hands. something is wrong, and we are saying, we are calling on all educators to come out and support this team, because their lives and their families are at stake anyway.
Anthony Williams, thank you. On the line from Klipspruit, I'm sure Letuli House would argue that you can talk about the Morogoro conference, but they'll throw the Freedom Charter back at you. Anthony Williams is an executive member of the organization Patriots for Equality. Well, while we were talking to him, someone who was listening to that is the Panyaza Lesufi. He's the MEC for Education in Gauteng, and he's made contact with us. MEC, good afternoon to you. I imagine you want to respond.
Yes, good afternoon, Stephen. I'm really disappointed and feel let down by the arguments advanced here. I mean, I've got a memorandum that clearly stipulates that the opposition is on the basis of color, that somebody that is not a color has been appointed. I've got a memorandum and posters that are all over that this is a colored area and must be led by a colored person. So we can't impose somebody who's not colored in that school. And I was engaged in a marathon of 5 hours. I met with the principal, or the acting principal. I met with the staff of that school. I met with the SGB. I met with the senior management of the school. I met with the community structures. I met with the parents of, and all of them were unanimous that the SGB does not represent them, but that SGB is the one that fueled the current debacle that we find ourselves in. We gave ourselves 72 hours to resolve the impasse, but unfortunately, because of the seriousness of the allegation, we felt we must not rush that decision of the appointment of the principal and give the community a right to make representation. But instead of making representation, they're shutting down schools, they're calling on colored teachers not to respond and not to come to work. They're disrupting literally everything. And it's not only that school. It has gone beyond that school. There is a school that is made of asbestos. In Rustaval, I was requested to remove asbestos of that school. We went there with our officials just to check people so that the contractors can start on site. That meeting was disrupted on the basis that we've not appointed a colored company. So there is a clear coordinated approach to disrupt the academic program in Gauteng on the basis of color and also on the basis of political points. So we can't be held hostage in our own school, Mrs. Steve. We just have to find a way of intervening, and that is why we still feel that we need to persuade, we still feel we need to discuss, but you can see we are discussing with people that are helping just to label us racist and label us playing with the race card, whereas they are the same people that are doing the race, that bringing the race issue where it's unnecessary to
play. MEC, can I put this point to you, and it is a political question, but yeah. In 2014, I remember the then new Premier of Gauteng, David Mukura, your deputy leader of the Gauteng ANC, went to one of these areas and he said that coloured people had been abandoned and that was a mistake by the ANC and that it needed to be fixed. In a way, it would strike me that you're paying the price for that now.
Let's understand the context. The context was that in terms of providing all the relevant support, infrastructure development, making opportunities available, and also ensuring that they are listened to. I think the Premier is still right in those particular issues, that there must be no community that must be marginalized. There must be no community that is excluded in terms of the main economic activities and also providing all the relevant resources that they need, which is correct. I mean, like we said, that the apartheid system undermines certain racial components and you need to reverse that. In reversing that does not mean that they're promoting race. The problem with this one is that the specifics, regardless of who's qualified to lead an institution, you say, I don't want that person. Regardless whether that process has been fair, you say, we don't recognize that process. Regardless that you are disputing a decision that is a recommendation of a community structure called the SGP, purely because their recommendation is not in your favor, you want to disregard. It has nothing to do with support. It has nothing to do with development. But it's a political agenda of an institution that wants to be known. It's a political agenda of an institution that believes they're well positioned to capture a certain market for them to be known and for them to be elected in positions of power, either in parliament or institutions of government. And if you can't tackle that part, we'll polarize education. You can see all the issues that they've raised. They have nothing to do with education. They have nothing to do with curriculum. They have nothing to do with... Actually, we are even investing in the school that they're rejecting almost 11 million to make that school beautiful and to ensure that that school is appropriately positioned to respond to academic challenges. I'm not raising all those issues. The only issue they really believe is race, is color, and that's where we feel that it's beyond us. We just have to find ways of bringing other institutions of government to assist us to deal with this issue. We don't want to rush the announcement of the principal because we know if we do that, we'll play in their hands and they will say, can you see, they've appointed somebody even if you have rejected that particular person. And I say, here are the academic credentials of this individual. Here are the minutes of the meeting. Here are the signatures of community members that signed and documented this person must be appointed. So let's find ways of really nullifying this process if we want to nullify. Give us reasons why we need to nullify that. And they've not been doing that. So we'll persuade them. We'll still continue to make discussion in this matter, Stephen.
That's the MEC for Education in Gauteng, Panyazala Sufi. MEC, thank you for making contact with us. Do appreciate it. Just after 12:30.
The Midday Report. Business.
With Stephen Grotus.
Britain's Serious Fraud Office says it's opened an investigation into suspicions of corruption at British American Tobacco and its subsidiaries. The company said last year it had appointed an external law firm to conduct a full investigation into allegations of historic misconduct in Africa. The cigarette maker says it intends to cooperate with the investigation. It hasn't given further details. BAT says it is aware of some of the allegations that have been made against it, but was appointing the law firm to given the number and the nature of the claims. And the rand's inched lower today as a bigger than expected trade surplus for June and a dip by the dollar failed to offset the impact of a warning yesterday by the ratings agency Moody's. Moody's said that it warned about possible political interference in our economic policy around the Reserve Bank after the public protector's findings. On the markets at the moment, the JSE All Share up 0.08% at 55,253 points. Resources up 0.63% at 34,658. Industrials up 0.3% at 75,062. Gold at the moment, $1,265.20 an ounce. Platinum, $936. And the rand to the euro, 15.68 to the British pound, 17.55 to the American dollar at the moment, 13.28. More, of course, on The Money Show tonight with Bruce Whitfield between 6 and 8 this evening.
The Midday Report. Stephen's on Twitter at Stephen Grotus.
21 minutes to 1 o'clock. Good afternoon. You with The Midday Report. Ragnar Lothbrok's got in touch. Hashtag Ragnar Lothbrok, I should say. He's tweeted a picture, which is from Klipspruit Primary, and it's a piece of cardboard that someone has stuck up, and it just says, this is a coloured area. So making the point there about what people in that area have said. Floyd and Kunasun, coloured Indian and white people will tell us they want a president who is their colour. This Klipspruit thing is ridiculous. Plenty of tweets on this. Lots of people with lots of different views. I must just say Pumzile Maldaka's angry, just saying they're just racist. One person who simply says that, you know, this is Boss Major, breaks my heart to see race being the issue for progress, but both Panyaza and the other guy make valid points. Okay, not many people seeing it in quite that equal-handed way. Leinster just saying, what a waste of 10 minutes. That guy's montashing on his own version of non-racialism, of the perceived racism in Klipspruit. Aye, he says. Join the conversation. Tweet me at Stephen Grotus.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
You're at the Midday Report where you won't miss a thing. 20 minutes to 1 o'clock. Don't forget you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and you can go back, listen to any of the interviews that we've done on the program. You can listen to Panyaza Lesufi, the Gauteng Education MEC and the representative of part of the Klipspruit community. We spoke to them just 10-15 minutes ago. Plenty else underway at the moment. Don't forget the High Court in Pretoria, busy place. Applications from the Reserve Bank and the Ahmed Timmel Inquest as well. On the front page of the Business Day today, a report that the Energy Minister Mamaloko Kubai has suspended the directors of the Central Energy Fund and has told the fund to explain what happened when the Strategic Oil Fund was sold off. Over 10 million barrels of oil from the fund were sold in secret when the oil price was at record lows in December 2015, which meant that the people who bought the oil then made a huge profit when the oil price went up. The person who broke the original story is now the deputy editor of Business Day. It's Carol Payton on the line from Joburg. Carol, good afternoon to you. Does it seem that the Energy Ministry may actually be taking some action here?
Hi there, Stephen. Well, one hopes so. I must just point out, though, that since our story was published, the minister at the time, Minister Kabai, yesterday decided she wouldn't comment, or her office didn't comment. And this morning her office are telling us no, that she has actually given the board an extension and she hasn't quite suspended them yet, but she is planning to, you know, she's asked them to make representations as to why. But yes, suddenly there does seem to be some sort of new interest in this. And, I mean, what I think, you know, was really the heist of the Democratic era with these 10 million barrels just suddenly being sold off without anyone's knowledge and anyone's, you know, any sort of the necessary authorities giving permission, now seems to be being regarded as a scandal.
The person who was energy minister at the time, Tina Jeanette Patterson, I mean, what role did she play?
Well, Tina was very involved in it, in the sense that she was approached by the Strategic Fuel Fund and with the suggestion that this should happen. And they, at the time, they disguised it, they called it a rotation. So in other words, they were saying, well, we need to rotate the stock, so we need to get fresh stock. But, I mean, oil actually doesn't deteriorate. Crude oil doesn't deteriorate. So it was a bit of a strange rationale. Anyway, that seemed to fly. And she's on record as having received all the letters from the Strategic Fuel Fund to say, yes, we're going to do this. And her saying, yes, that's fine. Just do it due diligence and it's all fine. And then 2 days later, bang, you know, the whole thing is sold. So Tina Jeanette Patterson does seem to have been involved in it somehow. And we have tried on numerous occasions to speak to her as to, you know, what her role was and whether she's got anything to say now that the new energy minister is, is digging into it. But she so far hasn't decided to speak to us.
Carol, I suppose the big question, you said it was perhaps the heist of the Democratic era, was the way you put it. Who played the big role? I mean, who would have benefited from this? Because it would have been a huge amount of money.
So the people who benefited would have been the buyers, because what they did at the time was that they sold the oil. So it was 10 million barrels. They sold it for around an average discount of $7 a barrel. And at the time, I think the oil price was something like $30 or maybe $28 a barrel. And it's obviously subsequently gone up. So whoever bought this, and it was at the bottom of the cycle, so it was pretty much a sure bet that the price was going up. So whoever bought it, and these were the big three oil traders who bought it, and we don't exactly know who partnered with who and whether there was a middleman and whether the middleman would have got anything. But so they really benefited by because now at this point they could sell, you know, at a huge profit.
Carol Payton, thanks very much indeed, the Deputy Editor of Business Day.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
In the U.S., President Donald Trump has now fired his, well, then new communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, just 10 days after he started in the job. Brooke Spectors, an expert on American politics. He's an associate editor at the Daily Maverick.co.za, a colleague of mine there. Brooke, afternoon to you. I suppose this is what happens when you use that kind of language with a reporter.
Well, Stephen, if you were to turn this into a movie script or a novel, nobody would buy it. Nobody would believe you. Anthony Scaramucci was bigger than life, with an extraordinarily creative potty mouth, and he managed to do all of the damage talking on the record to Ryan Lizza of the New Yorker magazine, who then dutifully copied it all down and ran the story. Not surprisingly, when the president decided that he really needed an adult in the room as his chief of staff, in this case John Kelly, former Marine Corps four-star general and most lately the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kelly must have made the condition, you get rid of Scaramucci or I'm not joining you. And Scaramucci was gone. Little technical correction, he actually wasn't supposed to start officially on the payroll till the 16th of August, which leaves him with the unique distinction of having been fired 15 days before he actually started work.
Brooks, in a way, what this has done is distract us from serious politics. I mean, it is reality TV within reality TV, if I can put it like that. In the end, does it really seem to weaken Trump?
Well, I mean, it's curious you say that because in reading various social media posts from friends in the U.S., they're saying all of this is happening deliberately to distract us from the larger failures of the Trump administration. I don't think that's quite true. I just think it shows the kind of fatal disorganization and the I'm in charge, you're fired mentality that Trump has brought to the White House. But it is clear that the lack of coordination, the lack of policy coherence, and these multiple contradictory responses to things have contributed to an inability of the Trump administration to move its ball forward in any coherent sense. So you just have to look at the repeal and replace Obamacare fiasco in Congress. They could not, with the majority in the House and the Senate, succeed in getting an agenda item they'd promised for the last 7 years across, because three Republican senators said, we're just not going to vote for it. Thank you very much.
Brooke Spector, thanks very much indeed. An American political expert. Tweets coming through to at Stephen Crutus. False pretender says the oil barrels we were talking about were sold to a Gupta Link company. Mark my words. I must say, false pretender, I have not seen any evidence of that at this stage. Don't tend to defend the Guptas, but I haven't seen that in any ways. And then Adam VDH was responding to Brooke Spector, suggesting that you couldn't make it into a movie script. He disagrees. He says you'd simply call it How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
The Midday Report with Stephen Hurtis.
You might have seen a report in the Times this morning about a new housing rental app. It's called HouseMe. It helps people to find accommodation online. They claim to have a very high success rate. Ben Shaw is a co-founder of HouseMe on the line from Cape Town. Ben, afternoon to you. What's the difference between your app and other ways of letting out property?
Hi, afternoon, Stephen. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. So HouseMe is a platform service. We connect prospective tenants to landlords only in residential rental. And what makes us different is three things, really. The first is that we're completely transparent about everything we do. We charge a very small retainer and only call-out fees for work that's required for a landlord. So we're at 2.5% a month. Secondly, we allow tenants to bid on what they're willing to pay. So instead of having a price forced down their throat, they're actually able to bid on it and put down a fair price. And then the third thing, which is, I suppose, the most exciting for South Africa in terms of technology, is we've managed to put the entire system together on a digital platform, accessible on house.me. And from that, we're actually able to serve both landlords and tenants and also agencies right across the spectrum, we're client agnostic, and we've managed to grow right across the country.
One of the big issues with renting out property, and it happens on both sides, is that the tenant needs to trust the landlord, the landlord needs to trust the tenant. Are you able to build that trust to make sure that no one ends up short of cash at the end of the day?
So that's 100% right. And one of the great solves of having an intermediary, and in fact why agencies traditionally have been such a powerful way of transacting, is because they eliminate that counterparty trust. Now, HouseMe's actually gone a step further than simply connecting landlords and tenants. We also offer a rental guarantee. So even if for some reason, which we do for free, we do all of our credit checks, our vetting, and our screening of tenants, even if for some reason something's gone wrong there and the tenant defaults, HouseMe will still pay the rent for a quarter of the year to the landlord as sort of a sign of our good faith to them. Likewise, on the tenant side, that's obviously a landlord benefit. For a tenant, if you're a HouseMe tenant, you're only paying 1 month's deposit, and you have us on call for emergencies and maintenance throughout the duration of your lease. And because of technology, because we can scale it, that's at no cost to the tenant at all.
Ben, one of the interesting things about accommodation is that different people will pay different amounts for the same property. I mean, people value things differently. Do you think the way you let people bid to stay in a property, is that pushing prices up in some way?
So very, very good question, and certainly one that I know tenants have asked several times. So I'm going to give sort of two answers to it. The first is a categorical no. So we're not there to push prices up. In fact, we have a number of case studies where our data, and as a tech company, we're very data-centric, sort of informs the landlord that the better thing to do here is going to list at a lower price, and then tenants are quite interested. The second, which is a different answer that I give you, is it does push prices up where demand is high. So you're finding around your urban areas, your metropoles, where there are 3, 4, 5 people interested, that the price does go up from the listing price. The advantage, however, which is something we've had to learn over the last while and is quite interesting, is tenants really appreciate that. I know that sounds a bit strange, but what we've done is we've removed discrimination from that process. So it's completely transparent. It's listed at 10,000 Rand, but if you're a tenant and whether you are a black female, a white student, a 40-year-old retiree, it doesn't actually matter. If you're a HouseMe tenant, you're able to pay what you think is worth you and get the property. So it's been a really interesting response, far more positive than negative. There are areas that have gone up, but likewise areas that have gone down.
Ben Shaw, thank you very much indeed. Co-founder of HouseMe.
The Midday Report.
Confirmation this morning that the Cheetahs and the Southern Kings rugby franchises will be playing in Europe next year and playing in what will now be called the Pro 14 tournament. The managing director of the Cheetahs is Harold Fester on the line from Pretoria. Harold, afternoon to you. How's the competition going to work?
Yeah, it's a very exciting competition. There will be 14 teams participating in this competition in two different locks. 7-7, so in the one lock you'll play a double round home and away, and then you'll play across the conference also a single round, maybe three matches away and one at home, or four at home. And then you'll also play your local team twice, like we will play the Kings away and we'll play them at home, similar for the teams overseas. So it's a very exciting competition. It will be broadcasted live on Supersport and other channels, and it brings something very special and new to the rugby scene.
It already sounds a lot more simple and easier to understand than the current Super 15. Harold, yeah. You're used to having to fly halfway around the world to play, but now you'll be in the same time zone. I mean, that could produce better rugby and it'll be easier for the TV schedule.
Yeah, absolutely. You see, what we've seen is that the schedule will be, we'll play Saturdays at 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock, and then maybe on a Friday around about 6 o'clock if one or two matches. But for scheduling for television, it's much easier. You don't have to watch it 11 o'clock at night on a Saturday or 9 o'clock just after breakfast on a Friday or a Saturday. So, yeah, scheduling will work perfect. And then to fly up north, I think it's a 10-hour flight. But you fly out 8 o'clock at night here and you end up in London or wherever. I think we'll fly to Istanbul, say, about 7 o'clock that next evening.
In the end, you do have to make money. Do you think you'll make more money in this competition than in the Super 15? I mean, will there be a subsidy in some way? Are you going to find that your travel costs are paid for?
Yeah, I think we'll be treated similar to Super Rugby franchises. So SARU will now be part of the Pro 14 company. They'll be a shareholder, and they will pay our travel and accommodation, and we will get the benefits from that company, similar to a Super 14 Super Rugby franchise. But there's an upside if we enter into the European Cup, and that's still under negotiation for not this year but the year after. Then there's some substantial increases in the financial gains for us, yes.
And Harold, I mean, Sanzar runs the Super 15. Would you be a little worried if you were them, if this works for you? Do you think the Lions and the Sharks are going to want to join you next year?
Yeah, you know, it was a long road to travel to get to today when they announced it, all the negotiations behind the scenes. And I must thank Yuri Ru, the CEO of SARU. He did a lot of work behind the scenes to get this thing really signed off and in place. But during discussions, some of the other unions said, look, maybe they want to join Pro 14 rather than stay where they are. But there's lots of positives in it. And let's see, we're in it for 3 years, and after that the scene will open up again. And if we're happy and lucky there, we'll stay.
And Harold, I know you're the managing director of the Cheetahs, but you are going to wish the Lions good luck for Saturday.
Absolutely, yes. Kevin Leclerc and Alt Rudolph, good friends of mine, and I absolutely admire Ackerman for what he has achieved with the team. They were down and out, and they restructured, rebuilt, and today they're the top super team. You know, it's absolutely a wonderful achievement. Him and Swayze the Brain, I know them well, and they're great rugby coaches. And we've looked at it. We try to understand what they've done. They made them strong and fit, and they gelled into a very, very tight unit.
Harold Fester, thanks very much indeed. Managing Director of the Cheetahs giving his backings to the Lions, only on the Midday Report.